Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, William English. Continuing with the theme of autodestructive art, I'm delighted to have in the studio the originator of the movement, Gustav Metzger, thanks to curator Mathieu Copeland. And today we're also joined by Clive Philpott, writer, curator and ex-librarian. So greetings to all of you.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Gustav Metzger was born in 1926 of Polish-Jewish parents in Nuremberg. In 1939, he came to Britain with his brother Max via the Refugee Children Movement. It's impossible to synopsize the extensive biography in a few sentences, but scanning Clive Philpott's chronology in Damaged Nature, Autodestructive Art, I singled out spells in a Trotskyist anarchist commune in Bristol in the 1940s. He became a vegetarian in 1943. Visits to the This Is Tomorrow exhibition at the Whitechapel Gallery in 1956. Living in King's Lynn and becoming involved in a dispute over the fishing quarter. And then he chose to become an artist instead of a professional revolutionary. 1959... three paintings exhibited at Monmouth Street, publishes the first autodestructive art manifesto in November 1959, 1960, active in the formation of the Committee of 100 Against Nuclear Weapons. Well, good afternoon, Gustav, and thank you very much for coming in. I was particularly interested in the time when you frequented the coffee bar at number 14 Monmouth Street, known as Brian Robbins Coffee Basement, I think. It was here that you met two other artists who, unlike you, were involved with drugs, apparently. And subsequently, the idea of setting fire to paintings was suggested at this time. I wonder if you could maybe describe something of that period, maybe that initial sort of conversation.
Well, I'll be happy to try. I think the key element in this period was the return to London, having left London late 1953, deliberately left London. I wanted a big enough distance that I wasn't close to London, and yet not too far, like going to Scotland. And the return to London was a difficult period, a very difficult period. And this coffee bar, which had just started in the summer of 59, was a kind of private, relatively private space where I could recuperate and have a chat with the owner, Brian Robbins, who himself was a kinetic artist at the time. And the two young men you just referred to were more or less habitués. They were practically always in the coffee bar or in and out of the coffee bar. And this conversation did take place where I think one of them said, how about organizing an exhibition, not necessarily at the coffee bar, but an exhibition of paintings and then burn them. Well, they did have struck a chord in me. I wouldn't say that was the origin of the idea of autodestructive art, but it certainly was a significant element. But the atmosphere in general was very open and somehow supportive. I did ask everyone at the coffee bar to sign the first manifesto, and neither Brian Robbins or one or two of these two young men wanted to sign it. Sure. So it could have been a movement, and in fact it was a statement, the first autodestructive art manifesto was a statement by an individual.
Do you know why they wouldn't sign it, Gustav?
I think these two young men were against authority. And I think they didn't want any integration of any kind with society. Brian Robbins was himself an artist, and I can imagine quite involved with so many other things. And anyhow, that's it happened along these lines.
So were there any other, inspirations at the time? Were there things that you might have heard of that could have inspired you to start the autodestructive art? I mean, were you aware of people like Eve Klein or...
Certainly, yes. Yeah. Certainly. I followed over the years the leading magazines. I would see them in some library, London library, not, of course, Kingsland Library. And so I saw developments which are, I think, moving towards autodestructive art. For example, Burri, the Italian artist, tearing canvases.
Yeah.
That was in the 50s. Mm.
Was it Fontana as well? Was he doing things at that time, the slashing canvases? Or?
Yes, Fontana was active in 1959 in terms of manipulating the canvas in original ways that relate to destruction. When I finally, and for the only time, met Fontana in 1960... After my one-man show at the Temple Gallery, I made a point of bringing out this painting on glass, the first public work of autodestructive art. And on the way to the Temple Gallery, I repeatedly asked him, "What is the element of destruction in your work?" And he flatly refused to acknowledge any element, destructive element.
Really?
And
all
on
right.
the way back, we probably continued, maybe, though I think it was rather silent return.
Well, I guess with Fontana, he was making an object which had a slight, but that's not, it still is very much an object itself.
Mm. And opening it up to space.
Mm.
Maybe. He said, "I'm concerned with opening up space."
Mm.
And that is that. So, and he continued to talk along these lines through the rest of his life, which is perfectly legitimate. That's his view.
It's interesting you say that he denied. Did he deny the aspects of autodestructiveness?
Yeah.
He was creating something, and it made me wonder how other artists reacted to your sort of thesis, because of course most artists are in the business of creating and trying to perpetuate their works. In history, did they see you as a threat?
Oh yes, oh certainly. I had enormous difficulties in the years following Manifesto. Actually, there was almost no one interested. There were a few young art historians like Stephen Bann, or art historians. And a few, very, very few, and the general public had no interest. The authorities, the leading institutions, rejected the general direction of autodestructive art.
Mm. But also, I was thinking of your sort of contemporaries. I mean, were people like Auerbach and Kossoff, were they painters that you were at college with, or were they contemporaries of yours?
Yes, yeah. We were in Bombay class for a number of years, starting in the early mid-40s to the beginning of the 50s.
Yeah, and did they sort of, were they affronted, as it were, by this idea, or perhaps that you were off their radar, maybe, perhaps they just weren't aware of what you were doing?
I think if they had heard, they wouldn't be interested. They were painters, pure painters, and quite legitimately.
Mm.
So
I haven't thought about it before, but you provoked the idea in me. Was this some gesture towards Bomberg himself, this sort of anti-painting gesture?
Well, there was obviously inevitably an element of rejection of Bomberg. And then I recalled for a long time statements along the lines which he made to me and possibly to others in the class or outside the class. The best pupils are the ones whose work is least like mine. Hmm. Now, when I was a young student, this must have made a very deep impression on me and probably an element propelling me towards something so radically different that it would include his statements.
If I remember well, though, wasn't Miss Bomberg, even though Bomberg had died by the time he did the first demonstration, Miss Bomberg let you know that she was deeply upset by your gesture, didn't she?
I have heard that. I've heard that she was upset, indeed, deeply upset, and didn't want to have anything to do with the subject of autodestructive art.
Really. But it's interesting, it was just because you've said one of the things that I've always admired in the very first demonstrations, it seems to me that it's not so much against painting, but it's a new way of making painting. Because as we discussed before, it has all the elements. It has colors, it has the stretched material on a stretcher. It had also the application of the of one element onto a surface. It just happens so that it disappears as it happens. The point I'm trying to make there, it seems to me it's also a celebration of art. It's also a celebration of painting.
Yes, and this is now being recognized in an exhibition planned for MoCA, Museum of Contemporary Art, Los Angeles, in a year and a half or so, organized by Paul Schimmel. And he is specifically including works that are, or at least there will be references to works that are autodestructive as part of a painting exhibition. Mm. And certainly I always saw the development of the acid nylon painting as directly expanding, contributing, developing painting, and this is now being increasingly recognized that it is so. And talking of painting, of course, the painter who was always most closely referred to in discussions of this acid paintings is Jackson Pollock. Mm. Jackson Pollock poured, yes, like I poured acid, if you like, onto a material he poured. And so if it comes to influences, then I would say Pollock would be an influence on my development. But I've said so publicly. I don't mind repeating it. I think my work went way beyond Pollock in its radicality.
Of course.
I shouldn't say that. It's impolite in England to talk positively about oneself, but I have said it, and I see it like that.
Well, again, one of the things which is admirable in the work that you've made, and you still make, actually, is just how it deals with the medium itself, but it goes beyond it. But just by, even though you were dealing with painting itself, you were referencing exactly the state of the world of that time.
The state of the world. Mm. This is so important. So many artists do not directly attack this problem, this issue of the state of the world. For me, it was a matter of life and death, literally, because if it was the state of the world that brought me to London, to England, and it's the state of the world which to this day, like this morning, listening to the radio, I'm connected to the state of the world. Mm. Necessarily so.
I'm just thinking, when you finished your work with the acid on the nylon, there's nothing, basically. Maybe a few scraps. That means to convey this to people, they either have to be spectators or it has to be recorded and disseminated in some way. And I wonder at the time how you felt about that. There was nothing after the small gathering of people who might have seen you do one of these acid on nylon pieces. How could you take it beyond that to a broader population?
This has been a great preoccupation from the beginning of turning away from painting. And it's ambiguous, it's uncertain, it's irresolvable. But I anguished for years in the 60s on this issue of whether performance, whether happenings, or my action should be recorded at all. And it was, of course, never resolved, but the discussion, the internal discussion, and, of course, discussions with fellow artists about the legitimacy of photographing an action continued and were very important discussions, and still, and it's ongoing. But there's no resolution.
No, but also the thing that you made clear from the first manifesto onwards was the fact that nothing should be kept and all the remains thrown away.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. This is another reason why documentation was such a dodgy issue for me all the years. Having talked about the elimination of the material, then allow the recording of it. But I always, in the end, came back to the desirability and the need to record so that posterity will have part, and then also to the discussion on autodestructive art, which of course includes the idea and theory of autocreative art, should be continued. How do you continue it without some trace in photography or film?
So you never actually wanted to become invisible as such.
No,
you didn't want to just
you
wanted to have a lasting legacy of some sort.
Indeed, yes.
Right.
I felt it. The art and artists are part of a developing civilization. And how do you see the development unless there's some evidence? Mm. And besides, I must again say, unashamedly, I think some of the photographs that have been taken are superb. And I mentioned particularly I won't go into details, but the fact that photographers came, took photographs, and which can be kept, I appreciate that very much.
Did it ever occur to you that at the time that by attacking the gallery system, which I think you did verbally, I mean, you were against the gallery system and against the museums quite outspokenly, did you ever think that you would ultimately be embraced by the art system?
I think it'll take some time before this unhappy point is reached. Not at all. There are individuals, there are institutions which have supported me and are planning to support me, but I wouldn't go as far as defining that as embrace. It's a working relationship, which in a sense is inevitable. After decades being so swept aside, there is a return in the other direction.
But there's one thing which has never changed, and which is always a great strength, is the never to engage with the gallery system. Since 1959, not to have any dealing with commercial galleries.
Yes, I've kept to that, and I'm sure I will go on along that route.
Yes.
This is the only way.
I think so.
But that's a differentiation between commercial galleries and, for instance, Serpentine.
Indeed.
Which gave you a major show not so long ago. So you see a difference between the two?
Yes, I see a fundamental difference. Uh-huh. The commercial gallery is, by definition, concerned with exploitation. The public galleries are concerned with distribution and with cultural developments. So that distinction I stick to, and I hope to stay along this division for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. I hope so.
I think that word embrace is interesting, that you may not have embraced the public sector, but I think they've embraced you. I think that says something which is not quite clear to me about the need for public institutions to deal with very difficult art and even antagonistic art. And I wonder if you have thoughts about why you are acceptable now to those institutions.
The change is integral, and we learn, the individual learns and the institutions learn. And so the fact that I've been given some opportunities is simply part of the normal activity of institutions. Institutions go with change, they develop change, and then at some point they accept change. And I see this as positive. I don't see any major conflicts between me exhibiting in, as there are coming up biennales in the next year or so. I think it's the job of biennales to reflect developments in art.
Presumably you don't feel you have to make compromises, but do you think you have to examine yourself quite closely to see you're not making some kind of compromise with that establishment?
I see no question of compromise in exhibiting in a public gallery.
Okay.
unless they dictate your work, which they have not done, and I'm sure they will not do.
But they do frame your work in a sense, and there are things like sponsors who might be encouraged by the fact that you're getting publicity for them and so on. The other things that trail behind a public museum these days. And I imagine if you feel you're not compromised in the way you present your art, that's okay, but it's not a totally pure situation.
Yes, and thank God nothing is entirely pure, because that would lead to so many of us directly committing suicide.
Okay, yeah, okay.
But also one of the things...
Pure and fine hair-splitting... I would ask the people who neglected me all those decades to question whether they were justified in practically letting me starve.
Sure.
Certainly starve of work commissions, work opportunities.
But also there was one thing that struck me, is that there's a great element of proactivity in your life and in your work, and how you've engaged and you've used museums and galleries in order to reach some point. For instance, I'm thinking about either with Dias, when you actually asked for the ICATO some of the events, or later on in 1970 when you did the executive profile in 1972, it seems to me also that you put the museum or the institution to your use. So it was never just an invitation to display work, even with you. It was always, it seems to me, as a means to still do a common society by using one of the platform, which is that of the institution.
Yes, certainly. One used the ICA exhibition on the leading financiers as a platform to attack finance, to attack the city from the city pages. That was the article accompanying
that exhibition.
Exhibition of executive profile. So it was intended as an attack. It was an attack, and it wasn't the only attack.
No.
There was an incident or an occasion, apparently, when you confronted Joseph Beuys. I think he was espousing a theory about everyone is an artist or everyone can be an artist. And at a conference, maybe in the 70s, and I think you stood up and said, can Himmler be an artist, or could Himmler be an artist?
Yes, you're referring to a major event in Cologne at the conclusion of a major exhibition, Westkunst.
Right.
And Joseph Beuys was at the center of a large panel, and with 700 people listening in, and in the discussion I stood up and made the statement, which I can repeat. Of course, I did this in German, but in English it would be Joseph Beuys, everyone an artist. And I paused for a while. Himmler auch, Himmler also. And then Beuys reflected for some time and spoke and said, yes.
Hmm.
Had Himmler had another education, he wouldn't have been Himmler.
Mm.
So that was the exchange. But before then, this was in 1981 in Cologne, before that in the Tate Gallery, as you might recall, there was a longer confrontation lasting about an hour, which is on tape and film. And there I question Beuys on some of his social ideas, ideas on society, and critically discussed this with him.
Yes, I suppose I did find that quite an intriguing idea, this idea of Himmler being an artist, because it seems, I mean, Hitler and Churchill, of course, were both watercolour painters in their own way, I think. It sort of, there is nothing to prevent, I mean, whether they were good or bad artists, I presume you'd class them as bad artists. They were not good artists. I mean, Hitler and Churchill.
Depends what you mean.
Well, exactly. But doesn't it sort of, the idea that you, as an artist, I'm not sure, isn't there a bit of a contradiction in this idea of, I'm not sure what your point is about Himmler. Could Himmler be an artist? You mean that had he lived his life differently, he could have become an artist and not what he was, but surely there is the possibility that Himmler could have been what he was and still be an artist.
Well, let's go back to the formulation, I believe, is every man is an artist. This, I think, is dogma. Mm. And I question that. If every man is an artist, then Himmler would also be an artist. And Beuys agreed. Yes, Himmler was an artist. And then Beuys went on, had he had another education, he wouldn't have been Himmler. So it was a complete cop-out.
Right.
I mean, a collapse of this. And nobody denies that.
Mm. Right. All right.
And also it's worth remembering that Gill came up with this proposal years before Beuys came onto the scene by the statement that on the lines that every man is an artist, but it's a much more sophisticated version of the idea that every man is an artist.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what book that was in, Gustav? Like his book on art, Eric Gill on art, something like that?
Well, it's certainly something I read when I was a young man in Leeds in 42, 43, and it had a very deep influence on me.
Did you perceive he was an anarchist at that time, or did you know that anyway, Eric Gill?
I came across his books in, say, 42. And
without preconceptions at that time? You just found the books?
Found the books on the shelves and was on the art shelves. And also it's worth remembering that Gill died, I think, in 1940, which means that in the magazines that I was reading, like or The Listener, there would be tributes to Gill. There would be reprinting articles. So I was led to Gill by facts of history. Gill was very heavily discussed at that time.
Only subsequently found he was anarchist. That's interesting.
Everybody was talking about Gill. He just died, and people were sorry and were reprinting illustrations of his, you know, line cuts, etc. And I was, without knowing it, moving towards art. And Gill was a very big part of that development.
Hmm. There's a brief quote from this is a book called Semi-Detached by Michael Landy, who did this the breakdown, you know, where you know, Michael Landy, the artist who destroyed all of his own possessions. And in the book, there's a quote by someone called John Slice, and he says, "Good times or bad, the real business of the art world is marginality, and fresh blood is an ideal product to take to a slow market." This seems to me a sort of dilemma with all of this. I mean, it's almost as though isn't the art market capable of incorporating just about everything and anything? As long as you remain an artist, you have it's going to be a dilemma.
Well, I think it all depends upon the position of the artist afterwards. Yes, they would try to. I mean, everything would be turned into an object for sale. Hence, I think the strength of the First Manifesto. If you say that there won't be anything left anyway, you're just denying the art market any possibilities of taking it over. But then again, when thinking about the void retrospective, some of the voids which were shown there belong to collections. So I think the pure materiality can be sold and can be bought, so can be reintegrated within the art system. But if the position of the artist is that not to engage within that system, I think that's... what I'm trying to say mainly is just that ultimately it's always the artist's stance which will define what are the possibilities and what are the challenges of the art market and how we can break that, how we can further that, how we can, I think, try to just, remain and win.
Anything can be bought. Relics, I mean, now is such a phrase as relics of the avant-garde, pieces of paper, bits of costumes, things like this. So you can't beat them.
But it sort of makes me think of, is it Laurie Parsons in the Voids book, who is an artist who ultimately decided to walk away from the art
world. Yeah.
And sort of said, it's in a sort of ultimate end game in a way, to walk away and almost destroy any trace that she was ever there.
Absolutely, and not having anything to engage with that system again. Well, I think it's a double sword, though. It implies that, yes, the artist wins, but then the art market will win in a way by trying not to keep the memory alive, if you see what I'm saying. And that's terrible. I mean, I do not condone that. I'm saying this is one of the wrong things. But that's true. I think that's why I'm saying it's ultimately the artist's sense. It's the artist's choice to kind of always go deeper and go beyond any possibilities forced upon us by one system. I think there's always ways of surviving and making the art that has to be made, or we believe it has to be made and has to exist, and can always go further and deeper than what the structure of the art offers you. But yes, we have to be cautious that a way or another, the system will always try to go back onto you. That's what we were talking on earlier about the commercial galleries. I think that is one of the worst you have.
Yeah.
And opposition to capitalism. That's what Gustav seems to be about.
Yes.
Opposition to capitalism, that is central. Mm. It is central to the whole development, and that is, if one is going to analyze myself in relation to others, that would need to be the key question. How does this kind of development differ from the general development, which is not concerned so much, at least, not so much concerned with society to the extent that I have been. But beyond that, there is the issue that what is the central issue? What is the central stake? And in my case, it is always the society, which is at the kernel of the development. I think that is the point where I'm distinguished from very, very many others, that it starts with politics. It starts with the big issues. The big issue and the big issues. And again, I hope to continue with this. And also, I believe it's this which gives me the energy. This is the energy, the kind of furnace in my life has been the need and the inevitability of dealing with the big issues.
And that's why at present you are engaging quite fundamentally with the idea of extinction.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I wouldn't have brought it up, but certainly for the last 3 years or so, this is the key question, the key program that I have is to try and deal, radically deal with extinction. And I do, we are coming to the end, I do very much believe that that is something that can be done, in as far as extinction now is almost entirely man-made. So if we can rein back the man and the men and the women and the institutions of society that lead to extinction, then we can stop it. Mm. And I believe we have to do, we have to stop extinction.
Yeah.
And I believe it can be done in 5 to 10 years. If we don't do it, we are in fact Himmlers. We are little Himmlers who are moving along fascistic lines to not only extinction in nature and the visual elements of nature, but towards our own extinction.
Absolutely.
And when I have the opportunity, as I do now, humanity is out to extinct itself. It is undeniable. All the evidence goes towards that. We are out to destroy ourselves. And if we could agree to stop the destruction of nature, at least it would be like a kind of pause, a breathing space from the extinction of ourselves.
And if I, and for you, the right corollary to extinction is biodiversity.
We have to protect, of course, yeah.
How do you fight despair? I mean, the signs of hope in this situation seem to be rather few, and plenty of the opposite. And I just wonder how it is you're talking about the energy you have to move on and fight, in a sense. And I wonder how you overcome the potential for despair.
Well, let me be personal. I am close to collapse. We all are, and I have times when I can't see moving forward. That's the situation. And
but as you've just said, there on the other hand, there is signs of hopes, and you've said in 5 to 10 years, if we do act, there is a chance to change the course. Since we're nearing the end, just have a bright piece of hope.
Well, I didn't want to bring it down like that, but it seems to me that I thought it felt like an ongoing battle, but the energy is always there, it seems, that when I see you, but of course that's when you're in public, so to speak. But there are moments when you do despair and you overcome that.
Well, yeah. I hope I overcome that.
Well, it would seem so.
Well, do you think that might be an opportune moment to wrap this up?
Yeah.
Unless Gustav would like to make a closing statement, he's more optimistic.
Well, certainly, it can be done. And it means a major social act. And above all, it needs to be a worldwide activity. Only a world change will have an impact on the rate of extinction that humans have initiated and are proceeding with.
Well, thank you very much to Clive Philpott, Mathieu Copeland, and Gustav Metzger.